listening to Current State from WKAR, your NPR station for the Capital Region. I'm Reginald Hardwick. We start with the arrest and arraignment of William Strampel, who was dean of the College of Osteopathic Medicine at MSU until December. He was also a supervisor of disgraced former sports doctor Larry Nassar, who abused hundreds of girls and women under his care at MSU. Nassar was sentenced to decades in prison for those assaults. He is now serving time in Arizona for child pornography charges. Prosecutors say Strampel failed to supervise Nassar and had his own sexual misconduct issues. Our Capitol correspondent, Shayna Roth, who was also a former prosecutor, covered Strampel's arraignment and joins me now. Hello, Shayna.
Hello, Reginald. Thanks for having me.
So specifically, what is William Strampel charged with right now?
Well, as you kind of alluded to in your introduction, there's kind of two categories of charges. One category are charges that deal with specifically with Larry Nassar. And those are two misdemeanors for willful neglect of duty. And these are basically saying that, you know, Strampel was Nassar's supervisor. He had a duty to oversee certain things after they found out some information about Larry Nassar and his practices. So specifically, one of them is that he did not properly supervise Nassar or require Nassar and enforce to do certain things and enforce these policies that came about as a result of an internal Title IX investigation. Things like using surgical gloves during examination, getting informed consent from patients for certain procedures, attendance by another employee in the examination room. Prosecutors are saying he was required to make sure Nassar followed those procedures and he didn't. The other thing that they're saying as far in this sort of category of Nassar-related charges is that he allowed Nassar to practice while this Title IX internal investigation was going on.
So, Shayna, tell me about the other set of charges that involved Strampel personally.
Prosecutors say that on Strampel's work computer, he had over 50 pornographic images and videos. These are, in some cases, what appear to be selfies by MSU students. And they're saying that because of this, along with a history of Strampel using his position to sexually harass or intimidate MSU students, that he is charged with a felony, misconduct of a public official. And then he's also charged with a high court misdemeanor, which is criminal sexual conduct in the fourth degree. And that's for one of the victim saying that Strampel grabbed her buttocks during an interaction that they had with each other. So those two charges kind of play into each other as far as the misdemeanor kind of plays into the felony.
What does Strampel's attorney have to say?
Well, we didn't get a chance to speak to Strampel's attorney, who is John Dackmack, until after the arraignment. And essentially what he had to say is that they haven't had a chance to review all of the details. They still don't know who these victims are. They're not named in the affidavit that the Attorney General's office filed. They don't know all the details of what videos specifically are being mentioned and things like that. But he did say this about his case.
My client denies that he ever engaged in any inappropriate touching of anyone, any student or otherwise. He denies that there was any quid pro quo for sexual favors in exchange for any type of standing within the university or the medical school.
So, Shayna, where do we go from here in this case?
Well, Strampel was released on a $25,000 personal recognizance bond, which essentially means that he can go home without necessarily having to pay anything. But if he does violate his bond, he will be responsible for that $25,000. Now, the judge also said that if he violates his conditions of bond, he will likely not just have to pay, but will just get thrown in jail while they wait for the proceedings to carry out. And Strampel had a lot of conditions. Some of them are, you know, the normal ones that he has to report to the court for different things. But one of them is that he is not allowed to come in contact with any current or former MSU medical students unless it's sort of through a lawyer or, you know, like all the attorneys are kind of present. So he's not allowed to reach out to any current or former MSU students. So the next step in this whole phase is figuring out whether or not there is enough evidence to go forward to a trial. And that's that preliminary examination.
Well, thank you for your insight, Shayna.
Thank you for having me.
We've been talking with Capitol correspondent Shayna Roth about the arrest and arraignment of William Strampel, former dean of the College of Osteopathic Medicine at Michigan State University. He is the second person arrested in connection with the Larry Nassar sexual abuse cases at MSU. You're listening to Current State from WKAR. In 2004, Bree Randall Gay was 17 years old when she complained to Meridian Township Police that she had been molested by Larry Nassar during a doctor's appointment. The department took his word over hers. Earlier this year, Township Supervisor Frank Walsh apologized for that decision.
We didn't believe her. We believed Nassar, and we missed it. And we're so remorseful for that. And here we are 14 years later when all that's come out about Nassar, and we've tried to make it right with her.
Soon, Randall Gay will work with Meridian Township to educate people about preventing and reporting sexual assault. Joining us by phone right now from Washington State is Bree Randall Gay. Thank you for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
I wanted to get your reaction to some of the news of the week concerning the Nassar case this week. As you know, William Strappel, dean of the College of Osteopathic Medicine, who supervised Larry Nassar, was arrested this week. And Strappel is accused of failing to properly supervise Nassar and committing his own sexual misconduct. What was your reaction?
I was shocked by the allegations against him and how he used his position to abuse so many women. However, I was not really surprised by the fact that he knowingly overlooked Nassar's behavior. I think that, unfortunately, a lot of people at MSU have overlooked sexual predators, and that this is a huge issue there.
Are you expecting other arrests?
I think that as this investigation continues, we will see more arrests, and we will see that there were more people who knowingly enabled Larry Nassar.
We're talking with Bree Randall Gay, who will soon begin a training program to help prevent and report sexual assault in Meridian Township. It's the same community where she reported to police about being assaulted by Larry Nassar, but was not believed. Bree, how will you be helping the community?
My goal is to empower victims to speak out and to give them a safe environment to do so. There are a lot of really great resources and programs that currently exist to address education to children, as well as education to adults about this matter. So organizations that I've reached out to and been in contact with include Darkness to Light, Kids Center, as well as Amy Long, a well-known expert in the field. And they have been more than willing to help assist me and our community in implementing this education. So our first meeting is April 27th, and at that meeting, we're kind of going to meet with members of the school to determine what's currently in place for children in the schools regarding education on sexual abuse, and see where we can, you know, add programs either for children or adults.
Do you conduct some of this training in the Seattle area already?
I currently work as a physician assistant in family practice, so I do have experience working with victims of childhood sexual abuse, and I do manage their psychiatric care.
Will you be working with police officers in Meridian Township?
I will be. Meridian Township is implementing sexual assault training for all of the officers, and I will be creating a video on my personal experience to share with them.
When you have face-to-face contact with young people in the community, what will you tell them?
I would say to these young people that their voices will be heard, and it is important for them to speak up if they feel like something isn't right. It's also really important for adults in the community to listen to children and to offer them support if they speak out about sexual abuse.
And lastly, here at WKAR, we've asked all of our survivors of Larry Nassar, what can the public do to help? What is your answer?
So I would encourage people to research educational resources on how to recognize signs of abuse and talk to their children about abuse. This can be found online. One of the programs that we use is called Darkness to Light, and they have online training programs for adults.
We've been talking with Bree Randall Gay, one of many of Larry Nassar's abuse survivors. She will soon start a training program in Meridian Township to help prevent and report sexual assault. Thank you for joining us, Bree.
Thank you.
You're listening to Current State on WKAR. Criminal Sexual Conduct, What Needs to Change? Is a four-part series airing Monday, April 2nd through Thursday, April 5th on WKAR 105.1 FM and AM 870 at 11 a.m. The program is produced and hosted by MSU Eli Broad School of Business graduate Connie Nesbury. WKAR station manager Peter Worf previews the series with Nesbury. Last year, she received a grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting to help begin her work.
So I set up interviews with 22 people from across the country, experts and survivors, and this is the result. I had to edit it down to 4 hours, and I kind of freaked out about that for about a month. But once I started editing, it was fun, and I'm just so proud of the show because I feel like there's no blaming or shaming of anyone in it. It's just talking about solutions.
I'm speaking with MSU Eli Broad College of Business graduate Connie Nesbury. She is the host and producer of Criminal Sexual Conduct, What Needs to Change. It'll be featured on WKAR April 2nd through 5th. Tell me, who are some of the guests that you'll be speaking with?
I can't say enough about the people that I interviewed. That they're all incredible, and they all have so much to share. The first section is on survivor healing journeys, and I spoke with Donna Jensen, who is an activist now, an author. She travels around to colleges putting on a play about what she went through.
My healing journey in seriousness didn't start until my early 30s. I was in the women's movement and consciousness-raising group back in the 1970s.
Bill Murray is the founder of the National Association of Adult Survivors of Child Abuse.
When you add to that the number of people who suffered violence or physical abuse or emotional or mental trauma or neglect and maltreatment, the numbers are absolutely staggering and overwhelming, and it should be shocking to anybody who doesn't know them.
He's got an international organization now. Sarah Hodges went through abuse, and now she has a company out in New York where she's helping people heal. She started the Beautiful Shame campaign to help people not feel ashamed of what happened to them. And Rachel Thompson is author of several books. Broken Places and Broken Pieces are two of them. I think she just came out with a new one as well. That's just the first segment.
Connie, what are your greatest hopes for what listeners, survivors, and friends, allies of survivors can use and take away from the series?
The whole point of doing this series was to raise awareness among people, focusing on solutions, not blaming or shaming anyone, but also acknowledging how we need to hold people responsible for their behavior.
Criminal Sexual Conduct, What Needs to Change? Connie Nesbury is the host and producer and graduate of Michigan State University. Thank you, Connie.
Yes, thanks so much for doing this.
Up next, 39 bills regarding gun rights and gun control are sitting in the Michigan legislature. But why aren't they becoming law?
But the chair previously had said that those bills are sort of indefinitely on ice.
Plus, MSU researchers develop a new way to check your blood pressure using your smartphone. And later, the invasive plant threatening Michigan's 11,000 inland lakes. You're listening to Current State on WKAR, your NPR station for the Capital Region. Welcome back to Current State from WKAR, your NPR station for the Capital Region. I'm Reginald Hardwick.
Vote them out! Vote them out!
From Lansing to Washington, D.C. and hundreds of cities around the world, young people marched last weekend to end gun violence.
How free are we if we're too afraid to go to the mall, to go to the movie theater, to go to school? How are we free if we're too scared to live?
Following the deadly massacre in Parkland, Florida, lawmakers passed laws raising age restrictions on the purchase of all firearms in that state, banning the purchase and possession of bump stocks, and setting a 3-day waiting period to buy any gun, including rifles and shotguns. So what about here in Michigan? Lindsay Van Hulley, Capitol reporter with Bridge Magazine, looked into the nearly 40 bills regarding guns before the Michigan legislature right now, and why many of the measures, frankly, are not going anywhere. Lindsay joins me in studio right now. Welcome to Current State, Lindsay.
Hi, thanks for having me.
First, it seems Michigan lawmakers are all over the board with this issue.
You know, since the term started in January of 17, dozens, you know, close to 40 bills at least have been introduced that have something to do with guns. And, you know, we wanted to kind of just see where things stand. Most of them are sort of pending in committee. There have been a few that have gotten out. But, you know, the other chamber sort of decided that, you know, now is not really the time to take them up. And it seems that, you know, the conversation is shifting a little bit from you know, expanding gun access and things like that to more of school safety and security. And what that looks like, I think, is still up in the air. Nobody really knows because conversations are still ongoing and things like that. But I think that seems to be where, at least in the Senate in particular, is kind of where the conversation is going.
What are some of the measures that stood out to you?
Well, there are a couple, both in the House and in the Senate, that have actually been passed out of that of the chamber and are moving on to the other one. But there doesn't seem to be interest in taking up either bill in the respective chamber. So in the House, there was a package of bills that would allow people to carry a concealed pistol without first having to have a concealed pistol license. That passed the House and is now in the Senate Government Operations Committee, and it's been there since June of last year. And so that's sort of known around Lansing as a committee where, you know, bills often go to die. And the Senate has sort of indicated that there's not really interest to take up that package of bills at this point, that, you know, the conversation about guns is really shifting towards school security. The Senate actually had taken up a bill that would allow a concealed pistol license holder to be exempt from a ban against carrying a concealed weapon in what are called no-carry zones, schools, churches, daycare centers, those kinds of things. That exemption would allow somebody to be allowed to carry a concealed pistol in those areas if they had at least 8 hours of training, there were specific requirements that were outlined, or if they were a certified firearms instructor. And so that passed the Senate. It's gone over to the House Judiciary Committee. But the chair had of that committee previously had said that those bills are sort of indefinitely on ice, that, you know, right now may not be the time to take those up.
We're talking with Lindsay Van Hulley, Capitol reporter with Bridge Magazine, about the 39 bills regarding gun rights and gun control in the Michigan legislature. What are some of the gun control bills that have been introduced?
There are a couple on that were introduced by some Democratic lawmakers in the House. And the first that I mentioned earlier, the so-called red flag bills, the Extreme Risk Protection Order. There was some talk and some interest among the sponsors to have a hearing on that, you know, take it up and you know, get some testimony from interest groups and people on both sides of that issue. The chair of the Judiciary Committee in the House has committed to reading them and actually held a meeting with the Democratic lawmaker who sponsored them, law enforcement and other groups to kind of talk about concerns. Some of the big ones were related to due process, that the subject of the order would not have to be present in court when that order is granted. So there were some concerns about, you know, having the person present and represented. And law enforcement also raised other concerns that had to do with safety of police officers. You know, if they were to go to someone's house and actually be there to take someone's guns away, could that create a dangerous situation, you know, a barricaded kind of situation? And so there were some concerns, I think, about how that might play out. The representative who introduced that bill has said that he's open to revisiting that and redrafting as needed. He had said he wasn't wedded to the language as he wrote it, just wanted to get a conversation started and is open to hearing the feedback from others. And that same group has also looked at, you know, looking at federal background checks as a requirement. But, you know, that's still in committee as well.
When you talk to lawmakers, what is the reluctance to move some of these bills forward on either side? Yes.
Some of it, I think, is just all of the reactions and the responses that came from Parkland in particular, I think, since that's the one that we're talking about at the moment. You know, there was conversation about, you know, how do we address the kind of the safety and the security issue in schools? A lot of different ideas, I think, and no one is really sort of coalesced around what direction that may take. Just because there are so many, this is an issue that is sort of full of emotion, and it's very I think difficult to have sort of one clear path on where to go. So it sounds like, for at least at the moment, that lawmakers are sort of taking their time to consider what path we may take and what might emerge.
Where does our state rank when it comes to gun laws?
So according to the Giffords Law Center to Prevent Gun Violence, Michigan has the 16th strongest gun laws in the nation. It also ranks 27th in the country for most gun deaths per capita. And so that group, which advocates for stricter gun laws, has sort of graded Michigan at a C.
Again, we're chatting with Lindsay Van Holly, Capitol reporter with Bridge Magazine, about gun laws under consideration by Michigan state lawmakers. You're a Michigan native, Lindsay, and you know there is an active gun culture here. Does that play a role in why some of these laws are not going anywhere?
You know, there certainly has long been a hunting culture in Michigan. That's, you know, a lot of people do hunt in the state. I think, you know, you have a conservative majority in both the House and the Senate that really value the Second Amendment and believe strongly in expanding access and not putting, you know, unconstitutional restrictions on gun access. On the other side, you have, you know, you've got people, Democratic lawmakers in particular, who say that, you know, we some kind of reasonable control on guns does not infringe on Second Amendment rights. And, you know, the governor has sort of tried to kind of walk that balance a little bit and say, is there something, some kind of bipartisan common ground that we can find that, you know, doesn't infringe on the Constitution, but also puts in some kind of reasonable controls or restrictions that might be able to find consensus among both sides. And so I know that he's talked about being interested in working on, you know, something to that effect.
I read in your article that an experience Governor Snyder had in college helped shape his position on gun laws. Tell us about that.
Part of his perspective on guns is related to his time in law school at the University of Michigan. And there was a shooting on campus that killed two students in 1981. So he was still a student there at the time. His perspective has been shaped partially by that. And so he is called nationally for, you know, that kind of bipartisan approach. Is there some kind of common ground that we can find?
Anything else that kind of stood out for you or that people should look for in your article?
The debate is certainly going to continue. I think that's happening nationally. The question for Michigan is, you know, in the next several months before this legislative term ends, obviously it's an election year, what kinds of policies may emerge in coming months? There have been talks about creating a system that would allow teachers or other school personnel to be able to access firearms securely locked in buildings in an active shooter situation. Those bills haven't been introduced yet. I think they're still in the drafting process. There's been talk about looking for ways to improve school security. I think the Senate is interested in looking at that. And so what direction that may take, you know, does the red flag legislation get rewritten and does that address some of the concerns? And then where does that go? Is there interest in taking that up yet this year? So lots of questions, I think, that we'll be watching for and looking to see kind of where that debate and discussion goes from here.
Thank you, Lindsay, for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
That was Lindsay Van Holly, Capitol reporter with Bridge Magazine, talking about the 39 gun laws now proposed but not moving so swiftly through the Michigan legislature. And we've linked to her article on WKAR.org. Thanks for staying with us here on Current State from WKAR, your NPR station for the Capital Region. High blood pressure can be a killer, and millions of people do not know they have it. Knowing that you have hypertension and treating it with lifestyle changes and/or medication can prevent heart attacks and strokes. Researchers at Michigan State University are developing a device that they hope will one day make it easier to monitor blood pressure. WKAR's Scott Pohl reports.
Checking your blood pressure usually means a visit to your doctor's office or maybe a pharmacy. Some people buy their own blood pressure devices. Those options, though, leave many people not keeping an eye on their blood pressure like they should. MSU Electrical and Computer Engineering Professor Ramakrishna Makkamala and PhD student Anand Chandrasekhar think there could be a better way, and the entrance to that better way might be in your pocket right now, your smartphone. Ramakrishna Makkamala.
We created a sensor unit and accompanying circuitry, and we put in a casing and we fixate it to the back of the phone. And the data recorded by the sensing unit is sent to the phone by Bluetooth.
Makkamala explains that instead of a blood pressure cuff, you simply place your fingertip on the device for a few moments.
There's some visual indicators on the sensor unit to guide you in placing the fingertip. Then you flip the phone over to look at the screen and hold the device at heart level. And now there's a cursor appearing on the screen that indicates your applied finger pressure. And there are two blue lines. You have to keep the cursor between the two blue lines. And once enough data have been collected, a blood pressure output will appear. And it will the measurement will automatically terminate. And the blood pressure reading here was 120 over 96.
The device also records your heart rate, and if you forget to test your blood pressure for a while, the app can send you a reminder. Anand Chandrasekhar says most test subjects get the hang of using this blood pressure monitor quickly.
We did this study in almost like around 60 subjects, and they could do it quite well.
If the test fails, your phone alerts you to try again. The prototype currently being tested about doubles the thickness of the smartphone. Makkamala hopes to make it much smaller, perhaps only 1 millimeter thick. That, he says, would allow it to be easily built into a phone or a smartphone case.
But that would only be good for the high-end users, people who buy Fitbits and things like that. If we wanted to reach, you know, broadly the population, we would have to work with a smartphone company to do that. And you could incorporate this kind of technology relatively easily on the back of existing phones.
The patent application process is underway, but the device needs to be validated according to regulatory protocols. Makkamala says that validation requires studying subject populations with a diverse range of blood pressure levels.
We didn't do that in our study because it requires a lot of resources, but I think that would be the next step. And, you know, if you could satisfy the accuracy limits by that the regulatory body set forth, then, you know, everybody could have an FDA-approved medical device in their pockets.
One other advantage to more frequent blood pressure checks is that averaging results over time diminishes fluctuations in readings attributed to factors like stress, exercise, or meals. We have a video demonstration of how this blood pressure monitoring device works at WKAR.org. For WKAR News, I'm Scott Pohl.
For the first time in the city's history, Detroit is requiring some developers to meet with residents before they get approval for large tax breaks. Shelby Jopie of our fellow Michigan NPR station WDET reports on the first year of Detroit's new community benefits ordinance and how it's shaping new development in the city.
For the first time in a while, downtown Detroit sounds like this. Backhoes and trucks are hauling debris from forgotten buildings. Cranes are placing the beams for new structures. But now, before big projects start, they have a new hurdle to jump over. The Community Benefits Ordinance that Detroit voters passed in 2016. The law requires developers of major projects to consult with the community before they seek tax incentives from City Council. The goals are, first, to give residents a part in discussions about how to lessen negative impacts of construction in their neighborhoods. And second, to have developers consider including benefits for the community, such as job training or improvements like parks. So far, 6 projects have been required to go through the new process, but there is some debate about whether the law is meeting its goals. Detroit City Councilman Scott Benson says it is. He campaigned for the ordinance.
This has wildly exceeded my expectations for this process and what would happen.
Benson points to the rehabilitation of the former Herman Kiefer Hospital, a few miles north of downtown, as a poster child for the new law. A New York-based development company is planning a $140 million rehab of the abandoned complex, turning it into a small hotel and walkable commercial campus. And they're doing work to improve the surrounding neighborhood.
You've had 150 homes boarded up. You've had one of the major local basketball courts has been renovated. They've started a minor home repair program, and the developers have actually moved into the neighborhood, and they have a great rapport with the local residents now.
Some Detroit officials say the first year with the ordinance has been a learning experience, with some pleasant surprises. For example, they expected one or two large developments to be subjected to the ordinance each year. Instead, six projects triggered the law last year, and two voluntarily went through the meeting process. Billionaire Dan Gilbert's real estate arm, Bedrock, is behind five of those projects, including the Hudson Site skyscraper and the rehab of the historic Book Tower downtown. Steve Ogden represented Bedrock and the company's projects at the community meetings.
This did not slow us down. What it helped us do is tell our own story. There's nothing they're going to be surprised by. They've heard everything.
Alexander Novak was part of those conversations as a member of the Neighborhood Advisory Council, a panel of residents required by the ordinance. The 24-year-old urban planner remembers what was going through her head as she listened to Bedrock representatives explain their plans.
So I was looking for every little detail, taking notes, trying to figure out what they did right, what they did wrong. And then, you know, how much power did I have? What was I supposed to be asking about? What was my actual role there? That was still really unclear to a lot of us throughout the whole process.
Novak says while she enjoyed working with Bedrock and felt like the company officials listened to the residents' concerns, she was a little disappointed with the eventual outcome.
They tend to dance around a direct answer, so a lot of the responses that we've gotten have been really unsatisfactory.
Like when several members of the advisory council expressed concerns about Bedrock's plans to demolish the historic National Theater and move its facade. The Albert Kahn-designed building near Campus Martius is over 100 years old. In the end, Bedrock did not change its plans.
We're kind of just thinking like, oh, well, I don't know why we spent all of our time and energy doing that if you weren't going to really care or try hard to respond to our needs.
While Bedrock did not agree to save the theater, Ogden says the company made other changes, like incorporating more green space into their designs. But the company and the city did not change their contracts to include any major community benefits. And according to the new law, developers don't have to agree to anything. In that way, Detroit's ordinance is different than community benefits agreements in other cities. It does not require specific outcomes. It establishes a process for starting the conversations. As the first projects to comply with Detroit's community benefits ordinance begin to make progress, city officials say they will be taking a look at how to improve the process. And Detroit will have more opportunity to practice the new law, with several major construction projects already slated for 2018.
Just ahead, the invasive aquatic plant threatening thousands of lakes across Michigan.
It can hitch a ride with boaters who travel from lake to lake. And last year, Thum's team discovered that it can even play dead.
Also, Miles Bridges leaves the Spartans for the NBA. Who is going with him? And what can we expect from the green and white game next weekend? We'll get some answers when Current State from WKAR, your NPR station for the Capital Region, returns. Welcome back to Current State on WKAR, your NPR station for the Capital Region. I'm Reginald Hardwick. Michigan has more than 11,000 inland lakes. They're places where people like to swim, boat, and fish, and many people buy lakefront property just to do that. But Eurasian water milfoil, an invasive aquatic plant, could change that. And it will hurt more than just the people who owned lake houses.
As Rebecca Thiel, a fellow NPR Michigan station WMUK, reports, water milfoil is tough to kill, and if you want to kill it, you have to trace its family tree.
Try and plow through this with a boat. You can see that essentially this lake is unusable.
This is a video John Tucci took 6 years ago at Pickerel Lake in Scotts. You can hear his boat working hard as it moves through the thick mats of the milfoil's fern-like green and brown tendrils. Tucci founded Lake Savers LLC, a business that controls unwanted aquatic plants, after having trouble with Eurasian water milfoil in his own lake. He recalls how shortly after his family moved in, his wife pulled their baby daughter out of the lake after a swim and found her covered in brown, smelly muck.
It just dawned on me that if we can't swim in front of our own house on this lake, why do we have this property?
And many of those lake houses aren't cheap. A study by Michigan State University showed that 10 years ago, inland lake properties generated $3.4 billion a year for local governments in Michigan. Scott Brown is the executive director of the stewardship nonprofit Michigan Lake and Stream Associations, Incorporated. He says today, that number is probably close to $5 billion a year.
The little mom-and-pop cottages that were built back in the 30s and 40s and 50s are being torn down in favor of these 5,000-square-foot mansions.
But things like Eurasian water milfoil make living on the lake less attractive, which means property values go down. And when property values go down, so does money for things like local schools and fire departments. John Speeder is the supervisor of Pavilion Township and president of the Long Lake Association. He says he's seen the impacts of this.
During the period of time when there was lots of weeds in the lake and we had maybe 30 to 40% coverage, the sales on Long Lake went way down.
So Long Lake residents started paying about $100 each to treat it with herbicides every year. But if left untreated, it still comes back.
So it kind of begs this question of, well, if all this management is being done on this species, why does it continue to be everywhere?
That's Ryan Thum of Montana State University. We reached him on Skype. He and his team in Michigan recently got a grant to study water milfoil statewide. Water milfoil doesn't die easy. It can hitch a ride with boaters who travel from lake to lake. And last year, Thum's team discovered that it can even play dead. That happened after they treated Gun Lake with herbicides.
They looked pretty dead for a few weeks, but after 4 weeks, you know, and the study was done with scuba divers, and we were able to show that the individual plants that looked like they were dead actually started regenerating.
Thum thinks the key to the milfoil's resilience could be in the plant's genes. He says some milfoil have genes that make it more resistant to herbicides, especially hybrid water milfoil, a cross between invasive and native varieties. Thum says the new grant will help researchers identify those resistant genes in a way that's faster and cheaper. For now, it's not so simple. Paul Hausler is a senior scientist of the lake management company Progressive AE. We talked to him on Skype. Hausler says it takes weeks to get results back from the genetic test. So long, he says, that sometimes you miss your treatment window for milfoil, the spring and summer months. That test is also pretty expensive.
The clients that we work with are not that willing to spend, you know, thousands of dollars just to find out what type of milfoil you have.
Even so, Hausler says genetic testing for water milfoil could save property owners thousands down the road. But some wonder if herbicides really are the answer. John Tucci of Lake Savers is one of them. He says the state needs to be looking into other solutions to the milfoil problem.
We like to say there's only three things you need to know about lake management and lake restoration: nutrient reduction, and nutrient reduction.
Tucci says his company aims to stop fertilizer from washing off lawns and into lakes, which keeps a lot of pesky plants at bay, not just milfoil.
All of this fertilizer becomes the fuel that overgrows the lake with weeds and algae.
But some lake residents are already running out of money to keep the weed under control. Daryl Smith is a retired professor living along Pike Bay in the Keweenaw Peninsula. He says he and his neighbors have paid about $100,000 to treat water milfoil on the bay for 5 years.
Then it's the last one that we have the money for, quite frankly.
If lake residents can't pay, Smith says they'll have to propose a local millage, a cost that he knows his neighbors outside of Pike Bay likely can't afford. I'm Rebecca Thiel.
You're listening to Current State on WKAR, your NPR station for the Capital Region. This week we learned at least two MSU Spartans are leaving the Breslin Center behind to play in the NBA. Could more of their teammates join them? Also, the annual Green and White game is only a week away. So what can people expect? Let's bring in current sports host Al Martin. Hello.
What's up, Rance? How you doing?
Not entirely unexpected that Miles Bridges would go to the NBA.
We all expected that. It was a surprise by many after his first year. He decided to go in front of the Spartan statue on MSU's campus and announce that he would be returning for a second season. He had lofty goals and expectations. He wanted to give Tom Izzo his second national championship. That was the motivation. And we all know this season ended with a thud, the second round loss to Syracuse. And Miles, in many regards, I mean, last year he was projected to be a lottery pick, a top 10 NBA draft pick, if he left after his first season. And now, you know, I'm seeing projections anywhere from 10 to 15. So go ahead and strike right now, because who knows what could happen if he did return for a third year.
And then on Thursday, we learned that Nick Ward will also enter the draft.
On Thursday, after Current Sports, I saw that he tweeted out, quote, "Spartan Nation, thank you for your support during my 2 years at MSU. Thank you to my coaches and teammates for believing in me. Thank you, Mom and Dad, for your love and support. With that being said, I will enter the 2018 NBA draft. I will not hire an agent at this time." In my estimation, I think Nick is probably really, really late first round pick, but second round pick in my estimation. So that's very shocking, because I really thought that Nick could have improved that stock and just improved as an overall player if he would have come back at least for a third year.
So it wasn't expected like Miles Bridges.
Not at all. Not at all. And then, of course, the third player in this whole conversation is Jaren Jackson Jr. Now, Jaren Jackson Jr., out of the three players that we're talking about, he is expected to be the highest drafted Spartan. Right now, Jaren Jackson Jr., I've seen projections anywhere from number one overall to six. He's going to be a lottery pick. He has the kind of game with that over 7 foot wingspan who can shoot the J, take it inside. His defense is remarkable. He's the type of player that NBA execs and scouts just salivate over. I mean, the dude can do it all. So, and you talk about ceiling. It's all about potential and ceiling with a lot of these players that enter the NBA draft, Reg. And right now, Jaren, out of the three, he has the biggest ceiling because of his body type and how versatile his game is on both sides of the court.
Well, let's switch sports. And as we mentioned, fans will get a first look at Spartan football next weekend. So, Al, what can they expect at the Green and White game?
Yeah, well, you know, this will be the first introduction of this Michigan State team that proved a lot of people wrong last year, flipping the script after going 3-9 now 2 seasons ago and going to a bowl game, going to the Holiday Bowl game and having success against Washington State. I mean, when you evaluate this roster, Reg, this is a roster that pretty much doesn't lose a lot of people. You know, it loses a few. You know, Hunter Risen is a name. You know, I really expected Hunter, because Hunter last year is a guy that, when his number was called off the bench, he came in and made plays. It's not like he needed a few passes thrown his way to warm up as a receiver, but he's now transferred from the program. But there's not a lot of turnover. That's the point I want to make here. When it comes to the key positions, there's not a lot of turnover for this Michigan State football team. Brian Lewerke, he's the guy that I'm really going to be looking at to see how he's improved after a really good season last year that really kind of put him on the map, so to speak. It's always a fun time. It's a fun time. A lot of kids during the Green and White spring game.
I was going to say, really, the greater Lansing community and the families that come out here, and they're all decked in their Spartan gear, and really the whole community shows up.
What I like to do, I've done this for the past 3 years now, Reg, when I've covered the spring game, is I don't sit in the press box. I'm like, you know what? If it's a nice day, again, I preface that by saying if it's a nice day, I go down into the stands and I actually sit with the fans and check out the game from that perspective, because I don't get a chance to do that when covering the game itself, when covering a regular season game. So I leave the press box. I go sit in the stands and take my notes. And I like hearing what the fans say in the chatter that goes around Spartan Nation within Spartan Stadium as they talk about their team. So that's something different that I do every single spring game. I try to make it a tradition, if you will.
Well, thank you, Al, for joining us.
Anytime, Rich. Have a good one.
And listen to Current Sports with Al Martin weekdays from 1 to 2 p.m. on AM 870 and FM 105.1 WKAR News Talk.
It's nearly impossible to categorize the musical style of the group known as Y Music. You can decide for yourself when the group comes to our area the first week of April. WKAR station manager Peter Worf explains.
A contemporary classical chamber music ensemble comes to East Lansing this Thursday and Friday. But while the group plays on familiar instruments, they combine in new and unusual ways and challenge what might be traditionally defined as a contemporary classical chamber music ensemble. Y Music, that's the letter Y, Music, is a group of six New York City-based instrumentalists creating at the intersection of classical and pop and other forms. Y Music employs strings, woodwinds, and brass. C.J. Camerari is the group's trumpet and French horn player and describes the genesis of Y Music.
About 4 years after we all graduated, we started seeing each other at sort of alternative music gigs, at concerts with bands, with Sufjan Stevens and The National, and groups such as these. And we were all sort of like, wait a minute, how did you get here? Like, how did you go from a conservatory training at Juilliard to playing with a rock band? And we all sort of had the same story. We sort of independently followed the same path and ended up, you know, using our classical conservatory training to play in this other style of music.
Naturally, a wide range of musical interests attracted the group's members to each other, but there was an even closer connection.
What I love about Y Music is we came together because of personalities, both social and musical, and not because there's pre-existing repertoire written for our group. There's no music ever written for this combination of six instruments. So we had to create our own repertoire.
Paul Simon, Bon Iver, Ben Folds, and Sufjan Stevens top the list of Y Music collaborations. C.J. Camerari says Y Music's upcoming MSU appearance began with another personal relationship.
I'm friends with the trumpet teacher at the college, Justin Emmerich, from college. He reached out about a year and a half ago and asked me to do a trumpet masterclass at the university. I agreed instantly. I was really excited to do it. And then a couple of days before I was supposed to come and do the masterclass, Y Music was asked to record a track specifically for the Grammys with John Legend.
I may not always love you, but as long as there are stars above you.
So I asked Justin, I said, hey, can we reschedule my masterclass? And he was like, well, if we're going to reschedule your class, why don't we just bring all of Y Music here? I was like, perfect. So I'm still going to get to do that masterclass on this upcoming visit, but also we're going to do lots and lots of fun residency activities with Y Music and then play a concert.
Y Music is in residence at the MSU College of Music Thursday, and on Friday night at 8, they perform at MSU's Fairchild Theater. I'm Peter Worf.
And with that, we'll say thank you for joining us. I'm WKAR Digital News Director Reginald Hardwick. For the entire WKAR News Team, we'll connect with you again next weekend.
This is perfect. Come kiss me one more time. I couldn't dream this up, even if I tried. You and me in.
home, it feels like magic on me. I'm right where I wanna be. Everybody's talking about heaven like they just can't wait.